Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The term empty nest has become a familiar one in today's society. It relates to that time when children leave home to begin life on their own. It certainly changes the family dynamic. Some parents go into a deep funk, others all but high five. Families, including the kids themselves, cope with the change in a variety of ways. Now, if you're an empty nest parent, how have you dealt with it? That's our subject today, coping with the empty nest. I'm Don Marsh. We'll also find time to talk about what happens when, after leaving, the kids return to that nest, as so many seem to be doing these days. That requires adjustments, too. Joining me in studio to talk about coping with the empty nest, Rebecca Olson is an empty nest mom and also president and CEO of the Webster Shrewsbury Rock Hill Chamber of Commerce. Ehi Okorua is a former resident advisor at Washington University and is an intern in the Office of Residential Life at the university. Psychologist Ron Scott is a consultant with Care and Counseling here in St. Louis. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you. Ron, I'd like to begin with you and ask you, what is really going on in this coping process when the nest becomes empty?
Well, when the nest becomes empty, what's happening is a change, significant change, in the way a family that's left is organized. And family reorganizations, family life cycles would be the sort of technical term, involve some significant amount of readjustment. Old patterns, old rituals, old relationships either are not there or are changed, and there's a need to kind of go through new ones. This is not an event that occurs as the kid pulls away from the driveway. It's an event that goes on over a period of several years. My experience working as a marriage and family therapist was that I would see couples coming in when the youngest kid was about 11 or 12, and they'd be talking about their problems, and pretty soon it'd become apparent. Their problems are pointing to that period 5 or 6 years later when they're going to be on their own or with their partner, and they're just beginning to ask the question, what am I going to do when they're gone? I don't know that I even know this person that I've been living with for the last 20 or 30 years. There's a huge amount of change and a huge amount of adjustment that needs to take place.
Is it dangerous for marriages when this happens, people suddenly find themselves together alone again?
Well, dangerous only in the sense that the problems which are there and may not be addressed because you found ways to sort of get along, and most of those involve working through the kids or jobs or whatever, that those problems become much more intense. They become exacerbated because you don't have the old patterns and rituals that kept you somewhat comforted. So it's not surprising that you see a lot of couples that are having a lot of difficulties when they've been married 20 and 25 years, because that's about the point when they're running into this. And even if you thought you could go back to the relationship that you had before you had kids, you can't. You know, I mean, you're 25 years older. Your spouse is 25 years older. The world is 25 years different. And you just need to, in effect, you need to find new things that make it worthwhile to be together and to make your life worthwhile.
Let me turn to Rebecca Olson and ask if you would relate your experience. Your daughter left for school 2 years ago, correct?
Yes.
You became an empty nester and you're a single parent. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Tell us what you went through.
Well, I had been a single mom with an only child for 9 years before she went off to school. So she and I were the household. We were a team. And when she left, all of a sudden, it's just me, myself, and I, and the dog, which wasn't a very good conversationalist. I had a four-bedroom house, two bath. And it was suddenly a lot larger home than in the past. It was sad at first. And I knew somewhere since that first day of kindergarten when I put her on the bus as a five-year-old, I knew it was the beginning of a progression where I'm not going to be with her as much over time. And it's gradual, but you still aren't prepared for it. The day I dropped her off, it was a little tearful. It was a little tearful drive home. I kind of got over it. But one of my hardest adjustments was what to fix for dinner. when you have a teenager in the household, you're always semi-prepared to feed them. And I didn't know what to do with myself. There were weeks where dinner would be microwave popcorn because I just didn't even think about it. And it's like, oh, I guess I'm hungry. It's 8 o'clock. What should I do? So that was difficult for me. I had been considering renting a room in my house, and suddenly the large emptiness of the house brought that to the forefront. Didn't have to worry about my daughter. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll get a roommate. That'll be better. And I think that person will occupy my bedroom. So I actually, and it's with slight embarrassment I share this, I actually slept in my daughter's bedroom for about 2 months, and thinking that it was for practical reasons that I was going to move out of my room and vacate it. And I abandoned that plan and went back to my bedroom. But I look back on that like, whoa, what was all that about, you know, that I slept in her room? So that was kind of interesting. But after I got used to it, man, I was unleashed. You know, I just had time to do all kinds of things that I had put on the back burner when I was a single mom, because I was real clear when I was raising her that she was the priority. You know, she came first. And so I benched a lot of activities I was interested in. I knew I wanted to join Toastmasters, and I put it aside because I'm a mom. I got to be here more often. Once I had 7 nights a week free, it's like I joined group after group after group. I ended up finding a website called meetup.com, which was the most amazing thing to create activities and things to do. And I suddenly became so busy that when she would come home for weekends, she's like, I'll be coming in Friday night. And I would have to say, I'm hosting a meetup. I won't be home. And she'd come home to a dark house. So I sort of threw myself into activity.
What if she becomes a boomerang and comes back? It's really going to change things, isn't it?
It would, indeed. No, I love it when she's there for holidays and for the summer. We're still a team, and we have our own lives, but we come together, too.
Ron, it sounds like Rebecca did exactly what one should do to get past this time.
And something that Rebecca was able to do, and a lot of people aren't, because they don't feel as free, and they maybe had not anticipated or thought about some of those kind of things. And in that process, I'm sure, Rebecca, that you explored a variety of different things, and some turned out to be more workable and more valuable for you. One of the things that your story points out really vividly, well, two things really. One is the loss that's involved whenever you have a change of any kind, and certainly a change involving people that are important leaving. And the other is the loss of role. All of a sudden, you're not, you can't do the job that you've been doing. You're not that person anymore. You have to figure out something else, because if you continue to occupy that mom role without any kids being there, you're probably going to drive your children who are away at college crazy, and you're not going to do any good for yourself either. And so what it really means is you really have to just accept this is a big change, and I'm not quite sure what it's going to look like, but I'm going to start and see where we go.
The losing the job analogy is a pretty good one. I imagine it's very, very, very similar to losing an actual job.
One of the differences is if you lose a job and you say to the guy down the street or to somebody that you know, a friend, I lost my job, they know that that's a bad thing, that, you know, they sympathize with you a little bit. If you have successfully launched a child, which is what you've been planning for and preparing for the past 17, 18 years, people assume that you should be happy about it. So it's hard, unless you can find another mother who's been through it, or it's hard to get other people to take your pain seriously. So often you don't have anybody really to talk to.
Yeah. I'd like to turn to Ehi Ogurua now. You've been taking all this in. You're a young person, a recent graduate of Washington University. When you left home, you did not leave an empty nest because your brother was still there. But now he's gone. He's down here at St. Louis University. Tell me what your reaction is to what you've been hearing here.
I really agree with everything that's been said, and now I almost feel bad for my parents, like, oh no, that's what they were going through. But this is the second year that my parents are completely by themselves at home, and it is hard. It was especially hard when my brother was a freshman, because I think that they did have to completely change their lives, because you don't realize how much of what we did that was kind of their social life, and like going to, you know, play practice and soccer practice, and that's how they met up with people. And so now you don't have that anymore. You have work, you come back, and you have dinner, and you watch TV. So it's a little different from what they'd been experiencing. They got so bored that they both decided they were going to go back to school and get another degree. So right now that's a little bit better. At first they would call us all the time, but they started to kind of, you know, find other things to do.
Did it bother you that they called all the time?
A little bit when I was going through college, just because you're stressed. But I just had to understand, you know, they just want to know what's going on. I think my brother was not having it. He's like, no, I have my classes. These are the times that I will call you. And he kind of set up a schedule with them. WashU actually gives each parent a book called Letting Go when their freshman enters. And so they reread the book when my brother left for college, and so I think that kind of helped them a little bit.
The other side of this coin is the fact that most young people, and those many of those that I have known, they're really happy to get out of the house and be starting this this lifetime adventure.
Yeah.
You're that way?
Yeah, I was really excited. I think, you know, Nebraska's awesome, but St. Louis is a lot better. It's nice to be able to just, you know, I don't know, make your own schedule and go out and see the town, things you can't really do in Omaha. But I was really excited to kind of be away for a little bit. I actually spent the summer before my freshman year here at WashU doing a research program. So it was nice to be able to get the process started early. And so while, you know, my peers were having homesickness when they were a freshman, I had already gone through that during the summer. So I was already prepared and, you know, got through that period of, oh, I want to be at home. And I was just really excited about being in a new city.
What would it mean to you if circumstances were such that you had to go back home and spend months back in the old house?
It wouldn't be horrible. My parents are awesome. But it's definitely a change, because when you get used to living by yourself and cooking on your own schedule, and it's no longer the family dinners that Rebecca mentioned, like you're used to your own way of doing things. And I think it would be hard to go back to having kind of that ritual that we did before I left for college. I would probably even get my own apartment, honestly, if I went back to Omaha, just because I really like kind of being independent and having my parents there as a support, but not necessarily there 24/7.
Sure. I raise that question because that is happening in so many households, as
right.
I'm sure you know these days.
Right.
And I know that kids don't like it and certainly understand what you're saying.
Right.
I've got to take a break already. We're talking about the empty nest and how to deal with that. My guests in studio are Rebecca Olson, who is an empty nest mom, Ron Scott, who is a psychologist, and A. Okorua, who is a former student, now an intern at Washington University. She left her with her brothers going to St. Louis University 2 years ago. Her family became empty nesters as well. Back to continue our conversation, and I am most interested in getting you in the audience to participate in the program. I'd love to find out what you're going through if you are in this empty nest situation. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We will take a tweet at STL on air, or you can also reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We are discussing the empty nest syndrome on today's program. My guests in studio are Rebecca Olson. She's an empty nest mom. Ahi Okorua is also with us. She is a student, well, was a student at Washington University. She's an intern there now. And Ron Scott is also with us. He's a psychologist. And we're talking about what happens when the kids leave home. Ron, back to you with regard to what Ahi has just been talking about with the notion she wouldn't want to go back necessarily and stay with her parents, but also the fact that, you know, parents can be a bit of a nuisance sometimes by calling too much and intruding on their new lives.
And of course, an awful lot of young people have to go back because they don't have the money to
exactly.
get an apartment. Yeah, it can be a real problem. And the problem ultimately is you can't go back. I mean, you know, back is not really an option, even though that feels familiar, and it seems like, you know, you would fall back into that, but the truth is you can't. And not only might you not want to go back as a young person, your parents probably don't want you back either, because you know, all of us they're trying to struggle through this time. Now all of a sudden everything changes on them again, and you know, if you're trying to find yourself as an individual or as a couple, and you're struggling through that, if all of a sudden you're mom and dad again or mom again, you know, that involves changing yet again and finding new rituals, because your daughter has her own way of making breakfast, and she's going to leave the kitchen the way she leaves the kitchen, which odds are is not going to be the same way mom wants the kitchen.
Rebecca, you had mentioned that you really adjusted, it seems like fairly quickly, a new life, and found yourself with all sorts of things to do, correct? But you also said before you went on the air that you found the departure for her second year was in some ways more difficult than the first. What do you mean by that?
She just left for Truman State again, and this has been 2 years. And I don't know why I took this one more to heart than in the past. And I think it was a comment she made. She says, I'll see you at Thanksgiving. And that was going to be 12 weeks in advance. That seemed like an awfully long time to see her again. And she has a new boyfriend, and she informed me Thanksgiving she'll be spending part of the time with his family and part of the time with our family. And that made me think, uh-oh, it's starting. I have to share her with another family. And I interpret that as we're going into another stage of separation. And that can be painful.
What about that stage, Ron?
Psychologists call this process the launching crisis. And it's not just simply putting them on the bus, obviously. It involves going to college. And in some ways, a child in college is still not out on their own. You think of them still as, you know, your child. They just happen to be in college. A boyfriend or a girlfriend significantly reduces the amount of attention they're going to be able to give you, or going to be willing to give you. And even when they come home for Thanksgiving, they may very well be bringing the boyfriend or the girlfriend, which means you're not going to get a lot of attention yet again. It's a process that continues when your child gets married. That's part of that process. When they have babies, all of those things further separate the nuclear family. And you really have to find a way to come to terms with that. And ultimately, just getting really busy may be a good start, but it's not the end of that process. You know, you really have to find new ways to relate, because you still need a relationship with that young person.
Ahe, any of this going on with you with regard to you're sharing your life with someone else as well as with your parents?
Not necessarily with a significant other, but having a stronger base of friends now, considering, you know, I think I want to spend New Year's, you know, in New York with my friends and things like that. And I think that's a little hard for my parents to deal with, too, like Rebecca was mentioning. And I would also say, being an RA, especially, you would think that the freshman parents have the hardest time letting go. But it's actually the sophomore parents, the second year, because at that point, their kids already have really strong friends. And so a lot of parents, you know, would say to me, I don't think my daughter or son like really needs me anymore. And sort of, so it's very hard to come to terms with that, because as a freshman, you're still kind of new. You depend on your parents a little bit more because everything's so new and fresh and you don't really know what you're doing. But my sophomore year, you kind of have it down. And so it makes parents feel a little more disconnected, and it's a lot harder for them to let go that second year.
As an RA, I'm sure you heard your fellow students talking about this sort of. What sorts of things were they saying? I mean, are they cognizant of this dynamic that's going on with their parents generally?
They are very cognizant of it. You would actually be very surprised. A lot of my residents would talk to me about, oh, I'm the first person to leave home, and I'm really worried about when my sibling leaves home, what my parents are going to do, because, you know, they were getting phone calls every day and getting emails. Sometimes I would get emails from parents saying, hey, is so-and-so doing okay? I haven't heard from her in a week. And I think you know, residents would sort of get a little frustrated because they were trying to move on with their lives and find a new schedule, but their parents didn't seem to want to let go. So that was a conversation that sometimes the residential college director would have to have with parents and saying, you know, your son or daughter is doing fine. You really need to just, you know, they'll call you when they can. I promise that they're doing well, but you just have to, you know, kind of sort of deal with this problem and let them live.
Rebecca, the use of social media, do you use it? Do you communicate with your doctor, with your daughter, via the internet, email, Facebook, whatever?
We generally text is the easiest with her. Uh-huh. We are friends on Facebook. And because of that, and I've given her many, many lectures about social media, she keeps it pretty clean on Facebook because she knows a lot of adults are her friends and family. But she did encourage me to get Skype after freshman year. She had a roommate in the dorm from France, and that roommate used to communicate with her mother in France quite often. So I got Skype, but we've never Skyped. You know, it's like, I got it. Okay, let's do it. And we've never done that. But, yeah, we text a lot.
And, I wonder about that. You're still kind of knocking on the door.
No, I do not. I do not. We kind of touch base on Sunday evenings. That's found to be a good time to have a telephone conversation. And then it's just as need be, we communicate. The one thing I have as a holdover from being the mom with her in the house is I keep my cell phone on all night long. Because when she was in high school, I always had a rule. If you ever need a ride, no questions asked, call me. And I keep it on all night long. Of course, she's 4 hours away. I can't really help her, but I keep it on.
What about, Ron, what about this social media? Do you think that helps in dealing with the problem or maybe could exacerbate it?
Well, like any other technological advance, it can be really valuable, but there can also be really big problems. My thinking is that you really need to communicate with your son or daughter in the way your son or daughter will communicate back. And texting turns out to be the most convenient and the most likely. And so I say text. I have Skype. Interestingly, I have a daughter in New Zealand, and we talk on Skype. But you do have to schedule it, you know, because you got to be where the camera is in order to be able to be on Skype. I think it's a wonderful way to keep a visual connection. But I think sometimes just the simplest and easiest, as long as, the whole job of raising a child is to help them be prepared to deal with the contingencies and difficulties of the life that they're going to encounter. And the life they're going to encounter includes social media. And we might as well, we don't have to be afraid of it, but we need to understand that that's where they are, and take advantage of it.
Let's get listeners into the conversation. We'll begin with Jerry in O'Fallon. Jerry, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was always a strange parent in that my children, you know, everyone always, you know, cuckoos over babies and things, but they got infinitely more interesting the older that they got. all three of mine are all out of the house, either employed or at school. And I enjoy the additional time with my wife, but also I enjoy seeing them and seeing what they've accomplished. And sometimes having been, you know, kind of forced into my daughter into an urban environment in Chicago where she goes to school, which is entirely different from her upbringing. It's tough to see their trials when things, when they have to go down a new road, and it's not always it can be bumpy at times. But they managed to get through it, and I'm kind of proud of the fact that if they weren't my children, they would still be friends, because we have a lot in common, and I find it just, again, infinitely more interesting to interact with them as adults, even though I'm still their parent and still some things, you want to have some say on. It seems like sometimes humans are about the only species that doesn't want them to leave the nest and go on their own. But I think it's a very healthy thing.
All right. Anybody want to respond to what Jerry had to say?
I think the process of empty nesting looks different with a father than it does with a mother often. I don't know that it is. I think fathers can be and are just as anxious about what's coming and feel the loss just as much. But one of the differences may be, especially with a mother who has been a stay-at-home mom or really focused primarily on mothering, is that the father's probably been out in the work world, and so he's kind of oriented more toward the world, and he's got rituals and activities that don't change during this time. And so, and let's face it, men in our world are not quite as cognizant of their emotional experiences and not quite as tuned into them. And often it takes a couple of years before they figure out that they, you know, are feeling something. And so I think there is a difference, although there are a lot of similarities too.
Rebecca, do you think the transition for you was more difficult because you were a single parent and didn't have someone in the house that you could go to and talk to and commiserate with?
I think that's – it's sort of a blessing and a curse. But in general, my experience was great. I think if you are a couple, unless you've got a strong marriage and you both have outside interests, I think it might be more difficult to be a couple and an empty nester, especially as Ahi said about certain parents where their lives are involved in the high school activities, you know, and their life was going to the football game. I've always been interested in lots of different activities. I just tempered them while she was my priority. But I don't think it was any more difficult for me than a couple.
You were not a stay-at-home mom.
Oh, definitely not.
Definitely not. I wonder if that might have made it easier because you weren't there all day and weren't preoccupied with the household.
I think it would, yes. I had a rich and full life as an individual while I was a mom, and I do now. So,
right. Go ahead.
I just think I think maybe my parents are a little weird, but I would say it was infinitely harder for my father to let us go than for my mom, even though it was you know, hard for both of them. But I think my dad would just – sometimes he would call and be like, oh, it's just great to hear your voice and things like that. And so I think – you know, it just kind of depends on – because I would also say my dad was the one who was also driving us to all the games and all these things and was very involved with our lives. But also in terms of what Jerry the caller said, I really think as we grow older, especially speaking for me and my brother, you begin to understand your parents a lot more and you're able to have conversations that you couldn't have had, you know, before you left for college. So if you really take advantage of that opportunity, you can have amazing conversations with your children and just reach a new level of understanding that I've come to really appreciate and love and understand my parents a lot more because they were able to, you know, think about what lessons do I want my kids to know, like that I didn't tell them before I left for college, and we were able to have that conversations when we came back home.
It's really a two-way street, though. Mm-hmm. Both sides have to be totally bought into, totally buy into this whole concept.
One thing I love what you said is as long as you've raised your child knowing you're letting go and that you respect and appreciate that child as they go through adolescence into their teen years and young adult years as not someone you want to control. I think the parents that have problems, and Ron can speak to this, is the ones that got really involved in controlling their behavior and their friends and their schedule. They are going to have a lot more difficulty.
Ron?
The parents that have the most difficulty are the parents that feel the most fear and anxiety about life and how difficult it is and how difficult it is to control things. And usually or many times that gets acted out in an attempt to try to control everything. When I hear somebody referred to as a control freak, I'm pretty sure I'm talking to someone who's got a lot of anxieties and fears. What happens when you have anxieties and fears? It's much more difficult to accept change. I mean, change is scary, and if you're really afraid already, you don't really want to deal with it anymore. So you try to hold on, and your kid's going to experience that and probably be less comfortable and less confident than A was when you came to St. Louis. And even though you knew it was difficult, you know, you came with a sense that you're going to conquer the world, and that makes that says something very positive about the way your parents were able to help prepare you.
Once again, let me give those telephone numbers to get folks into this conversation. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can also email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We have a couple of emails here. I'll read portions of them to get some sense of what these folks are talking about. Woman says, I've been a widow for 16 years. I've had three daughters go away to college. The youngest just began her second year away from home. The other two live many miles from St. Louis, working and pursuing graduate education. I would like to ask your guests what books have been written about this topic, particularly addressing the needs of parents who find themselves alone, either through the death of a spouse or divorce. Many times the focus of Empty Nesters deals with couples and adjusting to the new life they have together. There are many parents out there who are adjusting to life without their children by themselves, and we've talked about that somewhat. But the final question is, what guidance do you have, and are there any books available? Do you know of any books, Rebecca? Did you use any?
That is so interesting. Usually when I have issues in my life, the first thing I do is find books to help me if I'm not talking to people. In this instance, I did not, and I do not know of a book. I mean, my best suggestion is to get out there and talk to other people her age and socialize, but I don't know of a book.
How about you, Ron?
Well, there are probably too many books, and if you were to get on Amazon.com and put Empty Nest in, you're going to come up with dozens and dozens of books. The problem often is that books are only valuable if you can connect to them, if they're written focused in a way that works for you. There are also websites that are specifically designed for folks who are approaching and involved in empty nesting. One that I noticed was emptynestmoms.com, but again, a search on the internet would turn up all kinds of websites that can provide contact and connection. And one thing about your kids moving away is, you've known the parents of your kids' friends. You don't have a sense of being all alone in this process. So there are other people that you can touch base with. But I think you probably find there are dozens of books.
Right. We have an email here from Lindsay who says, my name is Israel, and my wife and I love being empty nesters. I'm 42, my wife 35. We've raised two wonderful boys, 21 and 20. Both are in college and are enjoying the process of becoming adults. Though we talk every day, they make it a point to be and maintain their independence. When I was a child, my parents drilled into my head that 18 was the end of their support and the start of my self-sufficiency, a technique we've used on our boys. Sound like a good idea, Rebecca, Ron, Ahi?
That's not how it was with me, and I think I'm okay. I think it really depends on the family and what works, and yeah.
Well, not all 18-year-olds are the same.
Right.
Well, no, and it says something about how patterns and values and practices are passed down from generation to generation. And sometimes because the generational pattern is more important than what's actually needed in this situation. If it works, it's great. But I suggest that it is a process. It didn't start the day before you were 18 and end the day after you were 18. And so you really need a long view.
Yeah, it's not a one-size-fits-all situation. We have to take a break. We're talking about coping with the empty nest, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. 382-8255 is our phone number. If you're dealing with this situation, we'd love to hear about your experience. 382-8255, that's 382-TALK. Email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about the empty nest syndrome. I have an email here from Debbie in St. Louis City. For me, the meal situation has been the most difficult. We've been eating yogurt and granola for dinner because I just don't know what to fix or how much to fix. We're also taking dance lessons, and I'm learning the guitar. I'm sorry for laughing, but I find that Just hilarious and wonderfully so. Don't you, Rebecca?
Yes, I do. Yeah. And more healthy than microwave popcorn, too.
Yeah, yogurt and granola, not bad for you.
I was talking to my daughter in New Zealand this weekend, and she commented, the two youngest are just in college this year, and she commented that she doesn't know how to work in the kitchen anymore because dinner was prepared with her daughter. They each had their own roles, and they kind of worked together, and it worked beautifully. And when her daughter isn't there, she isn't quite sure how to get all this together again.
Yeah, that seems to be a kind of a running thread in some of the things that we've been hearing, certainly at the table here, but also with the emails. Back to the phones. Let's bring in Lauren, who's calling from Afton. Lauren, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling because I am the eldest child of a recent empty nester, and I just thought it would be an interesting thing to add that sometimes as a child of a family who has become a recent empty nest, I find that I have to be more cognizant of my mother's emotions and make an effort to compensate for what she's feeling concerning my younger sister and myself. So I try to head it off and make dates with her and make plans with her so that she stresses less and that I stress less about her stressing.
What a nice, considerate daughter you are, Lauren. Thanks for the call. Ahe, what are your thoughts about that call?
I completely agree with her. I think you have to go through a process, especially realizing what my parents are going through right now with my brother. And I tell them every Sunday, you know you're going to get a call from me. And just putting that in my schedule, it's such a little thing that makes a huge difference to them. And it does really make you stress a lot less because they're not, you know, saying, you know, oh, like, what happened? Are you okay? Things like that. So it's nice.
I think the key here might be, and Ron, you could address this if you would, is the fact that you are calling the parents and it's not incumbent on them to call you.
Right.
The reorganization process, when a family goes through a change, goes both ways. As the adult, as the young child who is now an adult, you have to do some reorganizing too. And you have to think about your parent differently. You have to initiate in a different way and respond in a different way because you can't expect them to take care of this. And I think there is a process of beginning to recognize the emotional realities of your parent that you didn't notice before because everything seemed pretty consistent and it kind of went on the way it went on and there were all these rituals and dinner always happened at the same time and everything. And all that's changed. And so absolutely, it really is important to recognize that you're as the launched child, you're going through a reorganization process also.
I had this happen to me that when she came in for Labor Day weekend in advance, she called me up and said, okay, are you free for dinner Friday night? And it was just sort of strange to have her booking a date with me. Uh-huh. And I went, oh, yes. And then I could also plan something else for Saturday night because she already had plans with her friends.
You like that.
I did like that. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the phones and bring in Gia calling from St. Louis. Gia, go ahead.
Hi. I come from a family, a really large family, and I was the firstborn and the first one to be kind of given the door. There's the door, go take it. And what was really strange to watch my mom go through, talk about being the oldest one and the organizer, and it was kind of a double-edged sword because I was put on my own, but I still had a lot of brothers and sisters at home. And so my mom tended to hang on to the youngest child. She was the most, you know, closest to my mom. And so one by one, we all left. And here I was thinking, okay, sooner or later, I'm going to get a chance to actually have some alone time with my mom and, you know, talk about regular stuff and get close to her. And then she turned around and adopted more kids.
She had her own solution for empty nesting.
So I, you know, seven sisters and six brothers later, I'm now 52 years old, and I'm still trying to call in every once in a while, find out what's going on with mom.
I wonder if that's called refilling the nest.
Yes. Manu syndrome to talk about.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. She seemed like she just refilled the nest. She just couldn't handle it being, as much as she complained and moaned about all the kids, it's like as soon as we turned around, there was a month of emptiness. She restocked the house.
That's a great story, Gia. Thank you so much for giving us a call.
Have a good day.
You too. Let's bring in Madge calling from Clayton. She may have an answer to a previous question. Go ahead, Madge.
Hi. Hi. I'm actually the co-author of the book that your student mentioned, Letting Go.
Yeah.
And I dealt with my empty nest by writing the book in 1988. The book is now in its fifth edition, which shows you how many people are really concerned in dealing with this. And what I wanted to talk about was the effect of technology, because when we wrote our fifth edition, it was really the most daunting one we wrote, because parents are much more connected to their children now than they were, and it makes it more difficult in some ways to switch gears, because they're so accessible now at any time or day and night to each other that it makes it harder for both ends, really, to kind of move on. In some ways, it's great because they have more closeness to their parents, but in other ways, it's harder for the parents to move on, and it's harder for the kids to solve their own problems and become more self-reliant.
Madge, thanks for the call. Rebecca, you're sitting here nodding in the affirmative throughout Madge's call.
Well, I can't say that that was exactly my experience. You have to create that space, too, for your child. I mean, I haven't been calling her or, you know, stalking her, as she would sometimes call it. But you have to create that distance.
Do your parents, are they tech savvy? Do they use the...
Yes. My mom even used emoticons. She's she's a texting genius. Yeah. But it's really great, I think, because we are able to feel so connected and get in contact. But at the same time, especially with residents, we almost have too many ways to keep in contact. And so a parent can literally in one day call me, call the student, text the student, call the RCD, and also send an email. And it's just too much, too many ways to get in contact. So you really, like Rebecca said, have to create some space with all this technology.
Yeah, that's, Ron, an issue I started to raise a little while ago about having all these opportunities to contact when maybe less contact would be better.
Well, on the surface, you would think, well, the simplest way to do this would be to just have no contact for a while, and then, you know, they'll go on their way and you'll kind of adjust to a new life. It doesn't work that way. Cutting off relationships don't really help process through to new kinds of relationships. So the secret somehow or other is finding a way to work through new relationships with the relationship intact and connected. That there's no magic to that, and there's no right way or wrong way to do it. But if you have a sense of the goal being that you're going to end up with a relationship with your adult child who is much more like a friendship than it is like a dependent child, if you have some idea of where you're going, you have some way of kind of figuring out where you are in that process.
Rebecca, the idea, the notion of friendship with a child is an interesting one. Of course, you're friends with a child, but I don't think that's exactly what Ron... Is it possible to be a real friend with a child?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How about you, E?
I don't know. I'm friends with my parents, but at the same time,
it's different.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah. It's different because they can tell me what to do technically, and my friends in college can't really do that same thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I feel like I can come to them really with anything. So it just looks a little different.
Yeah. Back to the phones. Regina is joining us from St. Louis. Go ahead, Regina. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was enjoying your conversation. I'm an empty nester. I've raised five daughters, and I sent my youngest off to college 2 years ago. And it has really been an enjoyable experience for myself and my husband. I kind of raised my children coming up to be self-sufficient and independent. And so there were times when my daughters would call me from college and I'm 800 miles from you. You're going to have to solve this problem for yourself. And that really helped for us. And they had to realize that mom and dad had a life now, and it didn't center around them. And so once they realized that the focus was no longer on them and that we had a life, then we had a mutual understanding. And, you know, they call sometimes and I call sometimes, and it has just really worked out. Of course, my children don't live in St. Louis. I have two in St. Louis and three away. And so I think that has also helped ease me into the emptiness, but I'm loving it. I really am. I talk to my friends, and you know, I did so many other things when I was young and didn't have any children that now I can go back to some of those things that I was doing when I was younger. So it has been a great experience for us, and I think my daughters enjoy it also.
Regina, thanks so much for the call. One quick question. Did it get any easier from as much as you went through it five times? Was it easier the fifth time than it was?
Yeah, it really was. I dropped her off at school, and I think because I was a little older when I had her, so she was she grew up almost the only child because it's like 8 years between her and the last one, and so it was easier for her and it was easier for me.
Okay, well, Regina, thank you so much for the call. I'd like to get one more in, at least one more in. Ann is going to join us. Ann, go ahead, please.
When everyone was telling my son and myself that you should break away and let them have their space, he was going through a very deep depression, and he told me 6 months later that if I hadn't kept up calling and calling and kept telling him that it's my job as a parent to keep in touch, to know how he's doing, to help him during college, first year of college, he would have possibly ended his life.
Oh, Lord.
So I'm urging everyone to be as hands-on as possible from birth to forever.
And thank you so much, and thank God you were making those calls. This is the other side of the coin. You don't want to be too intrusive, but you don't want to totally let go.
Right, and you need to recognize that when these kinds of changes are occurring, individuals and family members are much more vulnerable to emotional and mental health issues. And so out of sight, out of mind is not necessarily a helpful way to proceed.
Ron, how long does this last? I mean, do parents ever get over it?
On the one hand, it lasts forever, but on another hand, you do get over it, of course. Grieving is, and that's a lot of what we're talking about, mm-hmm. Grieving is a process that you bump into from time to time. Something happens and a memory hits you, and all of a sudden the emotional experiences hit you again. That's a normal part of being alive and being a healthy person. So it does go on. And I dare say when your child has been gone 30 years and they come for a visit and they leave, you may be both relieved and a little bit sad. There's a little poignancy because it recreates, brings back up some of those kinds of feelings. It's not a bad thing. It actually can be a very good thing.
And Rebecca, even though it was a little harder this time to let your daughter go back to school, do you think you're going to reach a point where it's not going to be an issue?
I certainly hope so.
Well, we hope so, too. And Ahi, how about you? Well, your final thoughts on this whole process, given where you are in life right now?
I think it's just parents should realize they're not alone. A lot more people, I think we've seen by this, a lot more people go through it than you think. And it's really about reaching out and, you know, figuring out what that year of the emptiness is going to look like in terms of communication, and also figuring out what you're going to do. Be like Rebecca and find different things to do and find new friends. And it could be an awesome year if you just, you know, take the steps to make it so.
And, you know, Ron, we have a minute left, and there's a whole nother subject here, and that is the boomerang kids, those who come back. As a final thought, do you have any advice for parents who are undergoing this experience now and how they should be handling it?
The boomerang experience?
Yeah.
Prayers sometimes. I mean, it can be very difficult. But, again, just keep in mind, this is a process also, and change is not bad even though it's uncomfortable. You're dealing with children who are more adult, more independent, more differentiated, and you just need to be able to roll with that and try and be as respectful as possible.
And maybe establish a few rules along the way so that everybody's on the same page.
Well, there need to be rules no matter who it is that you're living with in the family.
All right. Ron Scott, thank you so much for being with us. Enjoyed seeing you again. An interesting program. Rebecca Olson, thank you so much for being with us. Good luck as you proceed forward in this relationship with your daughter, the new relationship. And Ahi, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a joy talking to you.
Thank you.
Good luck in your studies, and good luck to your brother. Her brother is worth a story in and of himself. He's quite a guy. We can talk about that some other time, maybe, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with City Museum co-founder Gail Cassily about her new memoir, and then we'll take a look at an effort to officially change Columbus Day to Exploration Day. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.